Morning, everyone. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for May 20. I will first ask the marshal to introduce the panel, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Riley, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And we have this first of two oral matters on this court's calendar, and then we have two non-oral matters we will be considering as well. The first matter is A21447, Colby Lake Fourth Association versus Hiscox Insurance Company as the respondent. And though we're proceeding remotely, digitally via Zoom, of course, as counsel are aware, everything else should be pretty much what you're familiar with. You'll see in the one box, and you can kind of see the small numbers now, but they'll be bigger once you start your comments. The 15 minutes for appellant's counsel, 15 minutes for respondent's counsel, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose for appellant. If at any time we lose you from technological reasons, we'll freeze the clock. At the same time, you might be frozen, and so everything's unfrozen together. And I'll just note, too, for any participants who might be considering the matter or listening, I should say that no recording is allowed pursuant to judicial branch rules. However, this proceeding will be made available on the judicial branch website within 24 hours. And we do ask counsel, you identify yourself for our record when you begin your comments. And so we'll start with counsel for appellant. You may proceed.
Thank you very much. Good morning to the court and to counsel. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Adina Bergstrom, and I represent the appellant Colby Lakes Fourth Association. The association is respectfully requesting that this court reverse the denial of a motion for default judgment by the district court and further reverse a sua sponte grant of summary judgment to the respondent, Hiscox Insured. The errors by the district court in this particular case resulted in a $1.1 million appraisal award on a first-party insurance claim for covered storm damage in favor of the association to be essentially turned into a zero award, whereby the association was deprived of all of its coverage for which it had paid a premium. In sum, the court erred by denying a motion for default judgment without any analysis of the Findon factors, without issuing an express order explaining its reasoning, and despite the fact that Hiscox Insurance had not met its burden of proving all four Findon factors. The record is clear and reflects that three of the Findon factors were not met at a minimum. Setting aside the issue of whether or not there was a reasonable defense on the merits, i.e., coverage defenses under the policy, no reasonable excuse was provided for the lack of answer for many months, despite the fact that Hiscox Insurance had been continuously represented by legal counsel for over a year prior to suit being commenced. There was no explanation.
Ms. Bergstrom, yes. If I can jump in and ask you to address the arguments in the brief that we have case law that would suggest if it's an attorney's mistake, we overlook it. And we only really hold delays that are caused by a party's conduct against the party at this stage.
Yes, Your Honor. And Minnesota law is very clear that neglect of a party is inexcusable. And in this particular case, no explanation. The record is devoid of any explanation for why Hiscox did not act. And Minnesota law, including the cases of Black versus Rimmer, the recent court decisions of City of Shoreview versus Amaral and Orcutt versus Cruz, as well as Safeco Insurance versus Holmgren Building Repairs, speaks to the fact that where a client itself is neglectful, that this court and the appellate courts are not as forgiving to those clients. In this particular case, Hiscox is a litigant, very similar to Safeco in the Holmgren case, that has extensive knowledge of litigation. If there is such thing as a professional litigant, insurance companies certainly fall in that category. There's no dispute.
Ms. Bergstrom?
Yes.
I think the record shows that the complaint was served on Hiscox's corporate office on September 12th.
That is correct, Your Honor. So they were properly served, and that was one of the considerations, actually, in the Orcutt case and in the Safeco case. There was proper service, that's undisputed. It's also undisputed that they knew about the lawsuit. You know, in that respect, counsel for the association also served the motion for default judgment again on Hiscox Corporate at the end of October because there had not been sufficient response and no answer filed. So there is no excuse here provided, and I would submit no excuse to this court for a learned litigant like Hiscox Insurance to not respond to a lawsuit. Certainly, they're a multi-billion dollar international insurer. They know what to do with a complaint.
Are you making any argument that that the case law relied on in respondent's brief, suggesting that we would overlook a mistake or delay or neglect on the part of an attorney? Are you making any argument that that case law is misstated or overstated? Are you making some argument that we don't just overlook neglect on the grounds of an attorney of attorney conduct, that sometimes that by itself can also be something we look at this stage?
Your Honor, exactly. The case law that is stated by the respondent is overstated. And because this court does look to both a combination of what the attorney has done. And in this particular situation, we are not talking about one mistake. We are talking about a series of decisions by the attorneys that have been appointed to the case, national and local counsel, where they are simply not acting with due diligence and not responding in the matter that the procedural rules require. So the law is very clear that even where an attorney makes a mistake, that is not necessarily excusable. For instance, in the Orcutt versus Cruz case, mistakenly believing there's no need to answer is not a reasonable excuse. I know that's been one of the arguments that was late posited by Hiscox, that they didn't know that they needed to respond to a complaint that had been served and not filed. That is not a reasonable excuse and has been rejected by the appellate courts, including this one. So to that particular extent, the overall circumstances herein indicate that default judgment should have, in fact, been entered in favor of the association. And at a minimum, remand is necessary on that issue. However, it's clear.
Ms. Bergstrom, can I? Yes. I'm sorry, you finish your comment. I was kind of just what you just said is a question I had, but if you want to finish your comment first.
I certainly will, Your Honor. So as recent as the City of Shoreview versus Emerald case, because there was not a sufficient explanation as to why the court granted default judgment in that matter, this court then conducted its own review of the arguments and it affirmed based on its own review because it didn't have a substantive Findon analysis to conduct review of. It conducted its own analysis and it affirmed the proper grant of a motion for default judgment. And I believe this court can do the same herein in reversing.
And that goes to the heart of my question, perhaps, Ms. Bergstrom. Would you agree then, number one, the court actually did consider Findon factors based on the oral questioning and then the supplemental affidavits? And number two, given the significant discretion a trial court is awarded, we don't just separate or interpose our differences, even if we have those, but we give discretion to the trial court. Why would we not do the same thing as that court did and imply the findings and the conclusions as it relates to Findon and affirm rather than reverse?
So in order of your questions, Your Honor, number one, no, I do not believe that there was a sufficient analysis in the record of the Findon factors. There was discussion on the records loosely about different items at the default judgment motion. There's no mention of Findon. There's no analysis provided of Findon. So our position remains strong that there isn't sufficient evidence either by way of a written order or of the evidence in the record that Findon was the linchpin for why the court made her decision. She essentially found, the judge found that there was a reasonable defense on the merits that warranted additional findings down the road, but she didn't address any of the other issues. She, in fact, implied that several of the factors had not been met because she ordered the affirmations. And I would posit to this court that those affirmations actually helped to prove there was no reasonable excuse. So from that perspective, no, I don't believe Findon has been met. As to your question as to discretion, yes, the district court does have discretion, but it is not unfettered discretion. There is limits on the amount of discretion that the court has. And in that regard, the court must expressly find all four factors. And this is in the Gams versus Houghton case, 884 Northwest 2nd, 611, where the court must expressly find all four factors. And again, that was actually reflected in the March decision out of this court in Orcutt. So you must find all four factors. And where there's a misapprehension of the law, where the court isn't applying those factual findings in a way that comports with Minnesota law, then there is an abuse of discretion. Is it a higher standard? It is. And I believe it has been met in a case such as this, based on the record that's been established.
Ms. Bergstrom, in the brief, it seemed like there were some comments made that not only indicated that the district court was considering at least one or two of the Findon factors, but also that the district court arguably is making a finding regarding the excuse or the explanation. Are you now backing off of that argument and saying that instead there's, I think you put it in your response to Judge Slater, that there was no analysis done in the record, when it seemed like in your brief you were arguing something slightly different, that there was some analysis and in fact an implied finding that would favor dismissal?
My response to your question is this. In terms of what was analyzed by the court, again, there's no mention of Findon. And there was no argument as to that. It was in the briefing. So in terms of this implication that it certainly hadn't been met, I think that an implication isn't enough. I think the case law states repeatedly throughout the history of our appellate courts that it needs to be an express finding, and an implication isn't enough. So that is part of the reason why we are asking for both reverse and, in the alternative, remand, because of that requirement that it be expressed.
Can I just clarify, Ms. Bergstrom, that suggests to me then, because generally at the appellate level, we would be reticent to analyze factors. And if your main argument is that we ought not to look for implied factors, it seems to me remand would be the most legally supported reaction rather than an alternative. But you disagree with that?
Remand is certainly an alternative, Your Honor. However, I would again point this court in the direction of the recently decided Amaro case, where this court actually did its own analysis and review of the arguments. So that is the basis upon which I'm standing for the direction that this court is going in terms of default judgment and the ability to review. But either is appropriate, Your Honor is correct, which is why we've argued both in our brief. I do want to switch gears, because obviously if default judgment is as remanded, that will still leave this open issue of the summary judgment motion. Most pertinently on the summary judgment issues, the court erred in two regards, one in plain policy application and the second in finding questions of material fact that should have gone to a jury. I'm going to first start with this issue of the 200-day limitation of time that Hiscox appeared for 2.5 years to never mention or enforce, and in fact paid replacement cost benefits, and then raised 950 days after the claim was filed that the association was no longer entitled to replacement cost benefits because repairs had not commenced within 200 days. This is an important issue for several reasons. This is an issue that Hiscox has raised on a number of association claims in Minnesota, and it needs to be addressed because it is circumstantial. And in this case, the circumstances show the plain language of the policy doesn't apply, and the court erred in that regard. The plain language of the policy is clear, and it states that after an actual cash value payment is made, that there is a 200-day period that would apply to the commencement of repairs. In that respect, it does not say regardless of whether or not an actual cash value payment is made. It says after. And that after language is extremely
important. Let me cut to the chase here, because it sounds like you're saying something that's slightly different than the plain language to me. It looks to me like there are two different after clauses. The first one is after the loss, you have 200 days. So the triggering date is the date of the loss. That seems a little bit different than what you were arguing now, where it seemed to be saying that the triggering date is the date of payment. I don't read, do you see that the provision says after payment, 200 days shall run? Or do you see that there's kind of two different things? And then we're stuck in this position of what happens if payment isn't made within 200 days? What does the contract say about that?
So the contract doesn't address what happens if payment is not made within the 200-day timeframe. And that's exactly our point. It's twofold. Number one, this 200-day provision talks about 200 days after the loss. You have to commence repairs 200 days after the loss. But that particular provision follows the first part of the sentence, which says after an ACV payment is made. Read together, that implies, or certainly the only reasonable reading is, that you can't commence repairs until you have your actual cash value payment. And so that time frame, that 200 days, wouldn't apply unless you have an actual cash value payment within your 200 days. That's also supported by the fact that nothing in this provision says that your replacement cost benefits are void. And that's required in Minnesota. If you're going to have a forfeiture of an insured's right to a certain coverage, and I would posit that replacement cost coverage is a very important coverage to especially associations, because Minnesota statute mandates that there be replacement cost coverage for the exterior. That the lack of that language is very key and very important. And cases like Nathy Brothers speak to that. You need to be express if you're going to avoid that coverage. And other portions of the policy, not this valuation provision, but other portions of the policy, such as the notice provision, speak to that. So the lack of that language shows that that language doesn't apply in this case. And even if it did, it can't be strictly construed. It is a timeline that would only be applicable as appropriate. And here, because we have literally years of investigation of the siding that's at issue, leading up to an appraisal where they need to see the siding on the buildings. And that investigation and delay by Hiscox required under the policy duties of the insured to maintain that damaged siding on the buildings through the appraisal process. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Bergstrom. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal, of course, and counsel for respondent, if you would identify yourself, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning to the panel. My name is Chris Goodman. I represent the respondent, Hiscox Insurance Company, Incorporated. The thrust of the questions for Ms. Bergstrom focused on the, the first issue raised in the appellate brief, which is the default motion, so I'll begin my comments there. If I could summarize the plaintiff's position with respect to the denial of the motion for default, it's a form over substance. This court recognized in the Amro versus City of Shoreview case that if there is something the court can look at to evaluate whether or not the Finan factors were considered, it will look for them rather than sending the case back on remand simply for those same findings to be spelled out in a written order. That's the case that we cite in our brief. So now let's look at the facts in this case. The colloquy during the hearing was, as we stated in our brief, somewhat different than a typical motion hearing, where, as we're doing today, there is a set amount of time for each party to present its arguments, and some questions perhaps are interspersed by the trial court judge. That hearing that I attended last January was far more of a discussion style format. And so that's why in our brief, we cite to the sections of the transcript where there's a discussion back and forth about the applicable factors. If I heard counsel correctly, there isn't a dispute that there was a reasonable defense asserted on the merits at the time the motion for default was denied. The other three factors appear to be in play. I'm going to take them in reverse order because I think the first one is low-hanging fruit. Factor four
Before you go through those, let me make sure I understood what you were saying there. Are you saying that you interpreted Ms. Bergstrom's argument to concede that the factor regarding the merits favors denial of the motion for default judgment? Because I thought she was kind of arguing the opposite, that factor on the merits would favor. I didn't hear her concede that. Is that what you're saying, that you thought she conceded that? Because we can ask on rebuttal if that's to clear that up.
I thought that was the case, but since you and I may have heard two different things, and I don't trust my memory as well as yours, I'll address all the factors. I'll do them in reverse order because I think this moves faster. Did we act with due diligence? The diligence is measured from the time that the counsel is aware that a motion for default has been filed. We have two affidavits from the attorney in New York, Jeanette Dixon, establishing, I believe, November 5, 2019 is the date when she became aware of the default motion. Within a week, I've been engaged. I asked for the attorney at the time, Bradley Hammond, for the plaintiff to grant an extension. He denies it. We respond to the motion and go to the hearing. the salient detail with respect to diligence and prejudice, which is the next factor I'll address, is that at the hearing on January 3rd of last year, counsel asked Mr. Hammond, representing the appellant in this case at that time, would you have granted an extension if it had been requested before you moved for default? And the answer was yes. That shows not only that we acted with due diligence, we're talking about a matter of days between notice of the motion for default and the attempt to remedy the situation, but it also, now segueing into prejudice, shows there was no prejudice. This court, Supreme Court in our state, has made clear that prejudice with respect to the Finden factors, it relates to the inability to prove a case or defend a claim.
Before you move to prejudice, Mr. Goodman, I'm curious to hear how you feel we should look at the statements from the district court. If we are in this realm of looking to implied findings, I think that some of those statements are important, including the one where the district court said something like they didn't do squat. And we're giving these large firms an opportunity to stick their thumbs up at how we do things in Minnesota, something along those lines. Wouldn't those statements be the basis for us to imply that there was a lack of diligence?
A couple comments on that, Your Honor. Number one, of course, at the end of the transcript on January 3rd of last year, the court says we're not going to enter a default. So clearly, whatever was going through the judge's mind at the time that comment was made, the conclusion was we're not going to grant the motion for default. So if we're talking about an implicit finding, there was no finding by the district court judge that the excuse for not answering or responding to the complaint sooner was unreasonable. Number two, I've got the transcript up on my screen here, one of the benefits of doing this from Zoom. And the court is saying, quote, you got screwed over by New York counsel and Mir and Gear caught in the swirl of files being transferred, period. I believe that's the text we're all referring to. What's the context there? September 12, 2019, as Judge Riley, I believe, asked earlier today, that's when the complaint was served. Coincidentally, that was also the same date that attorney Tony Krall at Mir and Gear sends a letter transferring his files to the Manning and Cass firm. The two affidavits submitted after the January 2020 hearing by attorney Dixon explain the information that her firm had when this file and a number of other ones were transferred. With respect to the transfer from Mr. Krall, the information was, here's a letter, I think it's Exhibit B to Ms. Dixon's second declaration, where the Smith-Jaden firm, representing the insured at the time, said, we want to extend the time to respond to the pleading through March of the following year, March of 2020. There was a tolling agreement in place, and there was a representation from attorney Krall that in the other cases that he had had with the Smith-Jaden firm, when they served to preserve the statute of limitations, to avoid the statute of limitations defense, they had always granted an indefinite extension. We're also, this wasn't addressed in the appellant's brief, there was a phone conversation between the Smith-Jaden firm and Ms. Dixon, I believe on October 15, 2019. Well, that's an important date because at that point, the complaint has been served. And as Ms. Dixon puts in her declaration, I keep calling it an affidavit, I believe it was a declaration, there was no discussion about A, the complaint having been served or why haven't you answered? It didn't even come up. To the contrary, the representation was, hey, we've been pocket serving these actions as we do in Minnesota, but there's we've been giving indefinite extensions to answer. That was the first conversation between the Smith-Jaden firm and Ms. Dixon, who was new to these files, as to how the Smith-Jaden firm was going to move through its inventory of these first-party Hale cases. I've kind of gone beyond Your Honor's question, but the point is, I've given some context to the screwed-over comment from the judge. The punchline from the court transcript, of course, is that the judge denied the motion for default. And I think I'll move on then to prejudice.
Can I just clarify, by the way, before you do that, sorry, Mr. Goodman, wasn't it though after that comment that the judge did allow for and request supplemental affidavits? Do I have my dates correct? So that would suggest either one of two things. If we accept your proposition, then the court made no findings and then obtained findings later to supplement what she said. But secondly, maybe the bigger question I have is, prior to the Amro decision, are you aware of any of our earlier case law, either our court or Supreme Court, which allowed for this concept of reviewing for implied findings where they're not otherwise explicitly made?
I can't say that I do, and I'd probably be unfair to say so because the only case we cited on that issue was City of Amarillo, which was decided in March of this year. So I can't give you any answer beyond that in terms of the development of the case law on the issue. With respect to the reasonable excuse factor, the ending of the transcript was we're not going to grant the motion, but the judge was going to require me to get an affidavit or declaration from the attorney in New York, which I did. So to Your Honor's question, was it possible that the court may have decided in the end to grant the default motion if the explanation from Attorney Dixon wasn't sufficient? That's a speculation on our part. I don't know. But I do know that the first declaration Ms. Dixon submitted wasn't sufficient. There was a request for another one. And I don't have the docket entry in front of me, but after the second affidavit or declaration from Ms. Dixon was submitted, there was a letter, which was kind of Judge Masch's style, to state that that was sufficient for the judge's curiosity or whatever you want to call it for evaluating the reasonableness of the excuse. There were some questions when Ms. Bergstrom was speaking about distinguishing between the courts in this state being loath to grant a default and not have a case resolved on the merits, which is the preference in all the case law, based on a mistake of counsel, as opposed to when there's a mistake on the part of the party, the client. And all the information that we have in the record shows that Hiscox had counsel. They were in the process of transitioning that, but they relied on counsel to respond to this pleading. And my earlier comments explained what was going on there. When this batch of files reached the Manning and Cass firm, the information in general and specific to this case was that no answer or responsive pleading was due. And there was no information conveyed in a phone conversation with opposing counsel a month after the pleading was served, October 15 of 2019, signaling that we're treating the Colby Lake pleading differently. That, by the way, you may have a letter in your file saying we want to extend the time to answer until March of 2020, but we're not going to abide by that. And of course, that would all be inconsistent with what Mr. Hammond said at the hearing last January, which is, to the judge's question, would you have granted an extension if they'd asked for it before you filed a motion for default? And he said yes. So that gives you some sense of the information that was available to the judge at the hearing, but then in the affidavits, declarations that Ms. Dixon submitted thereafter. And ultimately there was I believe it was in the format of a letter, where Judge Masch commented on the sufficiency of the two declarations that Ms. Dixon submitted explaining the conduct. There's simply no evidence that says that Hiscox knew that its counsel had not responded to the pleading within a finite number of days. There's no evidence of that. The evidence is to the contrary, that Hiscox got this information to its counsel and relied on counsel to prepare a response. There's no disagreement. There never was at the district court level that the response wasn't timely. But that's why we ended up discussing in the briefing and at the hearing the reasonableness of the excuse. Reasonableness of defense on the merits, if I misunderstood Ms. Bergstrom, I'll fall on my sword and we'll get into it. We pointed out in our brief and we're citing to the January 3rd transcript on this, it was not our burden at the motion for default hearing to satisfy any burden of production with respect to Rule 56 or any threshold in terms of the merits of the defense. Once you consider any evidence really that would develop in the case, the burden simply at that point was to say, if this defense is proven, would it be sufficient to avoid the claim? That is the paramount factor in analyzing the Finden v. Kloss, in doing the Finden v. Kloss analysis. Because again, the underwriting philosophy here in the state per the case law is we're not going to grant a party a default judgment, give them a layup, if it looks like the party had a meritorious claim or defense. And the defenses that we articulated at the time the motion for default was considered are the same two defenses that the trial court later adopted in dismissing the case. This is my attempt at a segue. I only have 2 minutes left, but I'll get into the summary judgment motion just to say this. Even if we didn't have the 200-day repair provision, and even if we were to agree that there were disputed facts, the bottom line is there is no replacement cost coverage under this policy or as a general proposition per couch on insurance until the repair work has been completed. It is undisputed now. It was undisputed at the time of the default hearing and when summary judgment was granted that this insured had not completed repairs with respect to siding, I believe gutters and downspouts, when summary judgment was granted. So at the time the default motion was denied, at the time summary judgment was granted, there was no right to the money that the insured sued to collect. Number two, we should not be hearing at this appellate level an argument that there are disputed issues of fact warranting remand. We cite in our brief a number of times where on the transcript and in their brief, previous counsel confirmed that the facts are undisputed, as they had to, they were moving for summary judgment, but also that the facts were undisputed specific to the 200-day repair provision. And so it is contrary to those representations to now say to the court that there are disputed facts that somehow create error in the court's findings. I got a minute and a half left, so I'll talk about the 200-day repair provision. We cite cases from outside Minnesota and the Bonnie versus Illinois State Farm case. A provision that conditions repair on a certain number of days is not per se invalid. The Bonnie case was a little different in that that required completion of repair. That, per the court's decision, invited an analysis of whether the insured had some money to do the work. In this case, all the Hiscox policy required was the commencement of repair. And in the, I believe it's document 68, this is the order that the judge issued after the request for reconsideration. The judge notes that the absence of actual cash payment at the time of the repair was an argument not raised when the court decided summary judgment, so it's not preserved for appeal. And also specious, given the fact that the property had been inspected and a statement of loss had been issued within the 200 days.
Mr. Goodman, wasn't there a dispute in resulting in an appraisal that took, 11 months? So how could an insured act within its rights to get an appraisal for actual cash value and at the same time meet this 200-day requirement?
That's the last thing I wanted to say, and if the panel will allow it, keep talking long enough to answer that question.
You may do so, Mr. Goodman.
Thank you, Your Honors. The timeline, which I have in front of me, there was no demand for appraisal, i.e. a dispute as to the amount of loss, until August of 2018. 200 days after the date of loss gets us into December 2017. The finding the district court made, and the one that I think this court should agree with, is that the insured cannot say to the district court or today to this panel that they didn't commence repair because they were concerned about whether there was coverage for the claim when there wasn't even a dispute about the amount of loss or even appraisal contemplated until more than a year after the loss occurred. And the last thing I'll say in terms of the dollars and cents issue, that was a distinction I was making between Bondi, which was complete repair within 180 days, and the Hiscox policy, which is commence. There is no qualitative or quantitative threshold articulated in the policy about how much work the insured has to commence in order to later preserve its right to make a claim for replacement cost coverage. That is a far less onerous burden than Bondi, which this court affirmed the enforcement of. So with that, I'd ask the panel to affirm the district court's decision on this matter, and I'll stop talking. Thank you.
Very well, thank you. And Ms. Bergstrom, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed. I believe you're muted, Ms. Bergstrom, but the marshal was paying attention, so we hadn't started the clock yet, so you may begin now.
My apologies. Thank you very much, Your Honor. I'm going to start where Mr. Goodman picked up, and that is with the 200-day provision. Here are the pieces in the timeline that are extremely important to bear in mind. Number one, parties always argue on summary judgment that there's no disputed issues of material fact, and those often arise in the context of summary judgment. Particularly herein, there were arguments raised that are preserved on appeal, including this issue of waiver and estoppel. Waiver involves questions of fact very, very often, and the Zolfi case speaks to that. So in that regard, the fact that there's a waiver argument and very clear evidence to support it requires at a minimum remand for questions of fact. Looking at this timeline, which is extremely important in this case, as of the 200-day time frame in which this commencement of repairs was supposed to take place, there is number one, ongoing investigation. In fact, letters even issued by Mr. Krall post-appraisal in August of 2019 indicate we are continuing our investigation. The duties under the policy require the insured to preserve property that the insurance company is still investigating. And at issue in particular was the siding. Okay, so you have that issue, number one. Number two, you have a confirmation that there's replacement cost benefits on day 359. You have payments of replacement cost benefits on day 484. That alone shows that there is an issue with whether or not Hiscox waived this particular requirement under the policy. And for that reason, at a minimum, there's questions of fact. Although it appears clear to me that it's definitely a waiver, the Bob versus Akers case speaks to this, where one party to a contract through its conduct shows it's not enforcing a particular right. It can't then use that provision of the contract later on when it's too late for the other party to comply as a means to escape its liabilities under that contract. So that is directly on point here, and it should go down for factual findings by a jury trial on that particular issue. There's also this issue with reasonable repairs. When was it reasonable for the insured to repair? Again, reasonableness is a question of fact that the district court should not have decided on summary judgment. And there is definitely evidence in the record on this issue. First and foremost, we have the issue of the appraisal of the siding, disputed scope of damage, disputed cost of damage. Those things required the siding to remain intact. Following that appraisal, the expectation was that payment would be issued for this one point, for at least the actual cash value, the outstanding amount of which is over $100,000 when you take into account prior actual cash value payments. Again, that was also an error as set forth in our brief in terms of how the court analyzed that appraisal award, which everyone agrees is binding. Following that appraisal, the expectation was payment would be issued. Mr. Kroll then sends letters raising, we have coverage issues, and I'm going to put that in air quotes, coverage issues, without explaining what they are. Sometimes insurers challenge an appraisal after it happens, so it's unclear what the challenge is or what the coverage issue may be. There is further communication by counsel for the association where they say, we intend to repair. Can we please extend the tolling agreement? No response to that. Then the long delay by Hiscox where they neither pay nor confirm or deny coverage, neither confirm or deny whether or not there's going to be another appraisal until December when we get into the default judgment proceedings. This long delay and lack of communication creates a situation where the insured, the association, can't run afoul of its policy duties, number one, has no payment to effectuate the repairs, which is critical under this issue of whether or not it's reasonable. There's been a distinguishing factor here between Bondi and this case, and I would posit that it is a distinguishment without a material difference. There are times when you cannot commence a repair within a certain time frame, just like there are times when you cannot complete a repair within a particular time frame. So in this, the context of this case, the impossibility argument under Bondi is directly applicable to this case. In that regard, it is important to remember that the timeline is key. And that timeline and the circumstances of this case require the reversal of the summary judgment decision and remand for finding of these factual questions.
Ms. Bergstrom, it seems like you and Mr. Goodman have different understandings of what the tolling agreement encompassed.
Sure.
And so what's your understanding of the tolling agreement?
So I will run over my time, so permission to answer your question, Your Honor.
That permission is granted, Ms. Bergstrom.
Thank you very much. The tolling agreement is quite clear. It's a very short document, and it basically states that there's a dispute that arose between the parties as to price and scope of repair, that the parties were working in good faith to reach a resolution of the claim, and that all of the deadlines, it says, the parties agree to toll the limitation period for suit under all applicable statutes and the policy as the parties continue to work together to resolve the claim. It also specifically references the appraisal award because it extends the date for tolling 60 days from the date of the appraisal award. So it's very clear that the parties are working together at this time after there's been a confirmation of coverage, after there's been payment of actual cash value and replacement cost benefits, that at this point in time, the parties are working together to bring the case through appraisal in order to resolve the case absent litigation. And in the meantime, every applicable statute, because it says all, has been told. That would include a two-year time frame for suit. That would include any time frames in the interest statute, because all of those are encompassed in that broad language of the tolling agreement. In close, if I may, Your Honor.
Yes, you may.
We are respectfully requesting that the default judgment decision be reversed, or at a minimum, that the case be remanded for express findings of the defendant factors in this case. We further request that the summary judgment decision that was sua sponte granted in favor of Hiscox Insurance be reversed in its entirety, and that there either be a finding of coverage under the policy for the entirety of the appraisal award, or at a minimum, questions of fact that must be answered as to the coverage defenses. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
And thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today and your briefing. Some interesting legal issues you've analyzed well and explained in your answers today. We will take the matter under advisement.